This is Snobs on Film.
I said, God help me.
Yes, well, however, is it your opinion?
It's my opinion. Trina did not drink that vodka.
Excuse me, Mr. Whitaker?
She saved the boy's life. That's...
Could you speak louder, Captain
Trina
Whitaker?
Trina Marquez did not drink the vodka. I drank the vodka bottles on the plane.
On the three nights before the accident, October 11th...
October 11th, October 12th, and 13th, and 14th, I was intoxicated. I drank all of those days. I drank in excess.
On the morning of the accident...
I was drunk. I'm drunk now. Because I'm an alcoholic.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening. My name is Arthur, and I am joined by Isaac, Jahan, and Aiko. And collectively, we are Snobs on Film, where we will explore the overlooked but wildly entertaining aspects of modern and classic cinema. Now, since the four of us have not been inside of a movie theater in at least 11 months, we decided to take this season and focus in thematically on the films that we enjoy and aren't talked about very often. So this season, the inaugural season of focusing thematically on films, we are going to tackle the theme of redemption. Well, first of all, everybody here? Because I know I'm just monologuing.
Yes.
Everybody's here.
Okay.
I was mesmerized, as usual, by your monologue.
I'm saying, I told you, I was going to come a little hard.
So let me get this right, though. All season, we're focusing on one theme. Redemption. Okay,
that's
all
right.
Season. Multiple films, one theme. I'm enthralled.
Shit, I am too. So, let's get to it. The film that we're going to focus on is Flight, the 2012 drama starring Denzel Washington, directed by Robert Zemeckis, screenplay by John Gatton, who actually was nominated for an Academy Award that year.
It's based on a novel too, right?
It's based on a novel. It's also based on an actual event. There will be spoilers, by the way. So let me right. Let me say that out at the outset.
Right.
So
obviously.
But this 2012 drama, airline pilot Whip Whitaker, who's played by Denzel Washington, suffers from drug and alcohol addiction, but he has managed to stay in the air. So he is a highly functional addict. His luck runs out, though, when a disastrous mechanical malfunction sends his plane hurtling towards certain death. Whip pulls off this miraculous crash landing that saves the lives of nearly everyone on board. But he's shaken to the core. And at that point, he attempts to actually get sober. But when the crash investigation exposes his addiction, his path to self-destruction accelerates while his road to redemption seems to vanish before his eyes. But I want to start with the main story arcs and the character arcs, that the journeys that these characters go through, because it's not just Denzel, it's not just Whip. And firstly, I want to start out by talking about the opening sequence where we are first introduced to Whip waking up in a hotel room with Katerina, who actually turns out to be a flight attendant as part of his crew. As the camera pulls back to reveal the setting, we see that there's cocaine, empty cans and bottles of beer, and harder liquor.
You know what? This opening scene that Arthur is describing, you know, the camera, like you said, the camera kind of pulls back and then it kind of moves around a lot, but yeah, it stays in like a wide frame for like a very long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Left side of the screen, we got Denzel, Whip, you know, in bed on the phone. Right side of the screen, we have Katerina, Trina, I think is what he nicknames her, kind of her name or whatever, but Katerina getting dressed and ingesting, you know, more drugs, you know, drinking more alcohol. But she's mostly naked through this entire process. Mm-hmm. And as I was watching this, and so I wanted to get you guys' input on, I was trying to, and I watched the movie twice, you know, recently to prepare for the show. And both times I was trying to process.
I'm sorry, the whole film or just the opening sequence?
No, the whole film twice. The opening sequence, okay. I'm not going to disclose how many times I watched that. But my point is, why was she naked? You know, she's naked, obviously, because she just woke up, you know, and they're waking up from a night of, you know, assumed a lot of sex, a lot of drugs. You know, it was a wild night.
debauchery. Mm-hmm.
Debauchery. Thank you. Thank you, Aiko. So that's why she's naked. And presumably Denzel is naked as well, right? But I was thinking, okay, is this more just, you know, gratuitous Hollywood, you know, naked women? Is that why we're seeing this? Or was there a reason? And I came in my mind later on, and we'll get to this later, but it's an arresting scene, obviously, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I have a comment to that, but go ahead.
So I just want to get you guys' opinion. Is there a reason for her to be naked, or is it just gratuity or gratuitousness?
You know, for me, I didn't take it as gratuitous. I did take it as a setting the stage for a film about excess. And there's something about, I don't know. I mean, I absolutely am not trying to say this for the effect to be funny, but I mean, there's something about full frontal nudity and drugs that seem to be the red herring for excess.
Yeah. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? Mm-hmm.
'Cause mm-hmm. at first I thought Trina was a call girl. Just because of the way that the whole thing was set up, you know, you know, he seemed comfortable in the same kind of manner as if you're comfortable with somebody that, you know, that you've hired. But then when you find out at the end of it that she's actually the flight attendant, because she's the one like, yo, we got to go. We got a 9 o'clock flight. Mm-hmm. You then see that, oh, not only is he, you know, not only is he wild, but he real wild and real bold too, because he's,
as is she.
Yeah.
It's jarring to hear that they have to be on a flight at a certain amount of time. And you're just like, yo, like you just like, there's a lot around you that you just did in all night. You haven't even had a chance to really sober up. Mm. And then you have to go deal with the public. Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
The other side of it is when we see Denzel and Katerina, but Denzel specifically, leaving the hotel room was sort of like a before and after. Like after they got themselves together, you see him in full pilot mode, aviator glasses, cap, full uniform, and he's strutting. Mm-hmm. And you see it a lot in airports, you know, with airline pilots. You know, they're walking like, you know, they broad shoulders, you know what I mean, shoulders back, you know, focus, and it's that aura of the airline pilot or the pilot in general, you know, who's in control, supreme bravery, you know, and control. 'Cause that's the thing that over the course of the story, Whip is losing rapidly, which is driving him to drink even further and further and further and further. But at the end of the film, and I'll just touch on it 'cause I know that we're going to talk about it more, but at the end of the film, when Whip needs to face the NTSB inquiry, you see that same kind of shot, Denzel center mass.
The Denzel strut.
Suit, yeah. Bold, aviators, the Denzel strut, and you've got that same mirror image that this is the role, this is the mood that he's got again. He's got to frame himself in this way in order to basically just deal and function.
Right, and to actually, you know, respect his authority. Like at the same time, it's almost like
respect
a surgeon. Like there's
right,
certain people,
right.
Like you just have to respect their authority because no one else can do their job.
So when they finally get to the plane, Whip meets his co-pilot, whom he's never flown with before. Young guy named Ken Evans. And he kind of gives vibes that he's a newbie. And immediately Ken is put off by Denzel's behavior. So he was a little shaky to begin with in terms of his confidence in his captain. But they have a short flight. They're going from Orlando, Florida to Atlanta, Georgia. So it's short and there is no drink service. They're taking off in foul weather, heavy, heavy rain. Immediately we see from Ken Evans' perspective, Denzel exhibiting what is regarded as reckless behavior. And me watching this, I immediately associated his excessive drug use and whatever went down the night before, to why Denzel is accelerating the aircraft into the inclement weather. He is evading the flight path by, you know, 30 degrees or something like that. To Ken's questioning and protest, like, yo, why are we deviating from the flight path?
There's an implied, you know, recklessness.
And you see Denzel pulling rank, tamping down aggressively Ken's protest, just basically follow my orders. And I'm straight up pulling rank. And Denzel does finally get to a calm pocket of airspace. There is some real tension that's established early in the film that really makes you not just question, but really makes you brace for a disaster to happen because Whip is an addict.
And then 20 minutes later or 30 minutes later, disaster actually does strike.
Right.
And he doubles down on the vodka, right? Like you see him between the takeoff and the quote unquote landing or the crash. He takes a break. Mm-hmm. He walks out into the main area. He gets on the mic to talk to the passengers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And with his left hand, he's holding the microphone. And with his right hand, he's got two little vodka bottles that he's pouring into his orange juice container. So it's not just it's not just the night before. You know, he's
he's fucked up.
He's getting alcoholic right at that moment.
Yeah, he's a highly functional drunk, and they established that alcoholic, and they established that very early, and it only gets reinforced when he goes full Denzel mode when catastrophe strikes.
Yeah, because the whole thing centers around this crash,
right?
Out of nowhere, while the co-pilot is actually commandeering the plane, while Denzel literally is asleep, at the wheel, the whole plane goes into a nosedive. It goes into an immediate nosedive.
And homeboy loses his shit. Let's make it known. The co-pilot loses his
not
shit.
Okay.
Loses his shit.
Preceding that, he's about to switch on the autopilot,
right?
And Denzel says, "No, we ain't doing that. I'm flying today."
Yeah, but I don't. You know, for me, that moment, it was like, yeah, that was supposed to make me feel something, but not knowing anything about flying, I didn't know. Okay, obviously that's not standard, but would that have helped them at all when the shit went down?
You know? Well, we don't know, but what I'm saying is it points to the fact that a drunk who is drunk and is getting more drunk is taking the decision to be drunk and fly when he could have taken the decision to say, no, let the computer do as much as possible.
Right. Mm-hmm. And also since Evans, the co-pilot, can smell that he says, I can smell the gin on you.
Right.
He also, when catastrophe strikes, I guess in his mind, he was like, oh, shit. We're diving, and this guy is not going to be any help because he's drunk and he's the lead pilot. Mm-hmm. So I feel that. Okay, this is a movie that will never be shown on any flights anywhere ever. Period. If you're watching this on your iPhone when you're on a on a plane, you're wrong for that. Because if anybody walks by and sees that, that's messed up.
It's a wrap.
So riveting. Yeah. It's probably one of the best flight sequences like I've ever seen on film.
Terrific.
And Zemeckis said he filmed it mostly from the inside of the cabin of the plane, as opposed to doing a lot of outside shots, because he wanted you to feel like this is what it would feel like if you were actually in. You wouldn't be outside the plane looking at it. You'd be in the, and that definitely brought the visceral feel of it up.
Yeah, it didn't feel Hollywood at all. Yeah.
It could have felt unrealistic because they make him Denzel, right? You know, he's in
command. He goes full Denzel, bro.
Yeah, he's full cool Denzel. As hell. He's in command. But,
full Denzel.
But they still make it realistic. Like that, the point that really sticks in my mind in that scene is when he's in control, but the co-pilot is losing it completely. The flight attendant, who has been the kind of picture of professionalism,
Margaret,
up to that point, and including that point, because she still makes her way at her own personal risk into the cabin while this plane is diving in order to help him like reach something that he cannot reach himself. Strapped in, and then he takes that moment to say, talk to your son, and she's like, she doesn't understand, and then he says black box, and then she's very emotional at that point, as you would be in that situation, despite kind of exhibiting that kind of real cool professional demeanor up to that point. It just kind of really heightened the reality for me,
and also brought to the forefront that even though Denzel or Whip was in full Denzel mode, there was still, he understood the possibility that we all still could die. Like this
he
may
was
not
present.
Work. You know what I'm saying? It was that scene. I mean, other actors could have played that, but to see Denzel go into Denzel mode, and for me watching that, it didn't take me out of the movie.
Right.
It wasn't like he was Denzel at that moment. And I've seen him do that in so many films where he gets that cadence and it's like, okay, I need you to do this. Are you looking at, are you listening to me? Do you understand?
Because he's managing these different personalities.
How many films has he done that in? But it's still, as I'm watching it, I wasn't like, oh, this is Denzel. I'm like, this is Whip going into Denzel mode.
Yeah.
You know, and it was fantastic.
He was undeniably terrific in it, but I think it's a credit to Zemeckis and the screenwriter as well, that, and the other actors in that scene, that all orbits his cool.
Right.
And that all gives it the kind of reality that maybe if it was just, if you had everybody acting in the same sort of way that he was acting, it would be entirely unrealistic. But we can stomach it because everything else around him is going to hell.
Right.
Right. And notice, Jay, he didn't tell Evans, the co-pilot, he didn't say, what's your wife's name? Because he knew, I need this motherfucker. I need him. Don't get emotional. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I need you. Mm-hmm.
Any more than he already is.
You know, Margaret, say goodbye to your son. You know, we cool. I know you. But this guy right here who I just met, I don't care. You got kids.
Absolutely.
Family. I need you to pull this flap. That's what I need you to do. To the point where the guy's like, the engine's on fire. Put it out.
Establishes again how what a high functioning addict he really is, because he's present.
Absolutely.
Like this, he's absolutely present 100%. So it's very interesting. And it makes the audience question, like, well, then this can't be his fault because he's still really present.
And they establish that fact just as strong as they establish that he is drunk and a coke addict.
Absolutely. 100%.
They got multiple problems, but the core problem is that they are dissenting at a high rate, and Whip has to do something to be able to slow them down. So the purpose, so Margaret's purpose for being in there was to do a manual override, some sort of maneuver that needs to happen mechanically, that Whip would be allowed to actually invert the plane, meaning he turned that plane belly up. And later we find out that by doing something like that, it actually helped Whip.
Yeah, it allowed him to stay in the air.
And they firmly established they do knew exactly what he was doing.
They established that he's got great ideas. We are traveling too fast. We need weight to stop us. Put out the landing gear. Okay, that didn't work. We are traveling too fast. We need to decrease our weight. Okay, dump the fuel. Yeah, he's going through his checklist. Mm-hmm. Smart guy. Mm-hmm. What they do not evidence, in my view, at all, until later on in the film, what they do not evidence is what caused the malfunction. I don't agree that we know at that point. Was it a simple mechanical malfunction, a defect in the plane, or was it the fact that this guy took decisions in the ascent when they were going through that awful pocket? Did that subject the plane?
I see what you're saying.
Did his maneuvers push the plane too far, etc.? Those are questions which when you throw in the fact that this dude is out of his head as well at this point, it throws into the question, did he play a part in this? Did he do something at some point when he sat down and when he, you know, turned on the ignition of the plane or whatever it was, and they went forward, did he do something? Did he do something that affected the plane, affected its flow, affected its trajectory, whatever? Did he play a part in this?
Let me ask you this though, Jay, just so I can just make sure I'm clear on what you're saying. Are you saying that by the time at this point in the film, we don't know everything, which of course we don't. This is the first 20 minutes of the film. But are you saying that by the middle or the end of the film, it's still up in the air?
Once he, you know, he goes to beg for support from the co-pilot, who is basically never going to fly again due to his injuries sustained in the crash. He tries to win over the attorney and his union rep because he feels that union rep is kind of minding his language. But he feels that the union rep is kind of looking at him sideways like, dude, you're a loser. He knows the attorney is looking at him directly like, dude, you're a loser. Because Don Cheadle, the attorney, tells him, look, you know, dude, you had 10 times the amount of alcohol you'd be allowed to drive a car in, you know, let alone fly a bloody plane.
So we
know all of that. But it's only when the co-pilot tells him, I didn't tell them, you know, that you were high. I didn't tell them that you were drunk. I told them that I don't know anyone else that could have landed it. And the union rep or the attorney, they also say, yeah, okay, you're a loser, you're a junkie, but you know what? We threw 10 guys at this in a simulation, not even in the real situation with the real adrenaline and the real kind of risk of all those souls on board. We threw them in there and they couldn't do it. At that point, we realize, oh, okay, this guy's a genius at what he does.
Yeah.
At that point, it's clear. But I think the whole, to me, one of the main kind of tenets of the movie is, wow, did he or didn't he? Mm-hmm. And if he did, do we want him to get caught?
I think that I feel what you're saying, but I disagree. I think that the fascination of this movie to me was that from the beginning, I always knew him being drunk wasn't why that plane crashed, you know, and that was interesting because it could have been very easy for the filmmakers to be like, oh, let's just make a movie about a dude who actually, you know, fucks up and, you know, and then he miraculously saves things, but it's really his fault why the plane crashed. For us as the viewer, it makes it very morally easy for us to be like, nah, he deserves blah, blah, blah. And this, when it gets to the scene where the airline owner is like, he deserves to go to jail, we could all been like, yeah. But when it got to that scene, I was like, I don't know. Does he deserve to go to jail? Because it's like, shit, he saved, you know, 90 something people. You know, if it wasn't for him, all those people would have been dead. You know, so that was the interesting part of the movie. And for me, it was never in doubt.
Can I just take a quick station break and acknowledge that it was wonderful to see Easy Rollins and Mouse reunited on screen again.
You stole my line. I was going to say that later. You stole my line. I was going to say that later.
You know what? I didn't even realize until you
Devil
said
in a Blue Dress.
I didn't even realize. Yeah. Of course.
The classic pairing.
Of course.
And Denzel as Whip banged up in the hospital bed, and we get the return of the Denzel glory tear.
Oh my God.
Anybody catch that?
This is like a Denzel greatest hit.
That's true.
Because later on, we get, I was going to bring this up too, but later on, we get Hurricane Reuben Carter. We get that. And then in the jail when he's writing a little letter and everything. We get it all. We get all the Denzel hits.
Greatest hits. Greatest hits. But when Denzel wakes up in the hospital and he sees the union rep, his friend Charlie, played by Bruce Greenwood, and within a matter of minutes, Charlie acknowledges that Denzel's not at fault. Like in other words, the weight of things is not being placed on Denzel. They're actually looking at the plane. So, you know, for me watching this, you know, Denzel begins to try to partition out his own responsibility in putting all of these lives in danger, because the weight of that would just crush anybody. And we see later that he knows he needs to redeem himself. He knows he has a debt to pay, because when he's discharged from the hospital, when he runs to his father's farm to get away from the press that's staked out, not just in front of the hospital, but staked out in front of his condo, we see him immediately. The first thing he does is start to go through all of the stashes of liquor and weed that he has, flush it down the toilet, pour it down the sink. He was like scared straight, but he's not communicating that to anybody. He's still keeping it in himself. He doesn't want to acknowledge in any kind of manner that he was drunk when he was in that plane, because he knows that all eyes right now are looking at the mechanics of the plane. Like he sees a path out of this, and he doesn't have to face his own responsibility to it.
That's a great point. I want to get you guys' opinion on this, starting with you, Aiko. He, at that point, because this is the moment of this is the beginning of his path to redemption, that hospital bed, right? And when he opens his eyes, you know, if at that point, to your point, Arthur, he's like, he's starting that conversation with Charlie, and he's like, okay, they're not looking at me. At that point, he don't even know that they've taken his blood, which is a side note, hilarious scene later when he realizes they took his blood. I laughed out loud. That shit was hilarious. But just the look on Denzel's face. But at this point, he doesn't know that. And so for him to make that choice, and this is what I want to get you guys' opinion on, for him to make that choice of redemption, you know, when it wasn't, he could have went on and, you know, like, oh, they don't know. It's like, they ain't looking at me. Cool. I'll just go on my life. For him to make that point, I'm interested in, I have a theory, but I want to hear what you guys got to say. Why did he make that decision when he could have, it's almost like he escaped, but why did he make the decision to want to redeem himself personally by, you know, going to the farm and dumping all the alcohol? Starting with you, Aiko, why do you think he made that decision?
Well, as
at
you
that
mentioned,
point?
Well, Arthur mentioned him being in the hospital room and that being like the first step towards his redemptive arc, is that basically knowing that Katharina was killed, because he didn't know initially who passed away and who didn't.
Obviously,
and again, because of the way that it wasn't quite established, like there wasn't, you didn't know how deep their relationship was, but clearly he was affected by it because of the glory tear. Like you start to see like, oh, he really does care. But you also see within his character how in the hospital meeting Nicole and all of these other people that start to come into his life, John Goodman's character that comes in to help him, Harley, that comes in, help out. Like he's used to compartmentalizing his life. He's used to also having control and hearing all of this and knowing before knowing that they took his blood, like he's also trying to manage all of it. And just have control, like, hey, it, like his position is himself as a pilot, like he's just used to being able to control everything. So it's just like, okay, well, I've not done any of the work. And you also see the background of Nicole and her own addiction issues. And she's already on a path of being scared straight because she's already hit rock bottom. This is Denzel's rock. This is Whip's rock bottom. Like, regardless of whether he's responsible for it or not, he was highly inebriated, coked up, and, you know, he's piloting a plane with all of the, as they kept reminding me over and over again, what was it, 106 souls or something like that? I forgot the exact number, but they kept reminding you. And also there's a lot of like Christian elements that come into play as well, like the conversation in the hallway and some of these other little things that come in that, again, go back to, you know, redemption.
So Is it second chance?
Yeah.
Because I mean, you know, redemption has so many different type of, you know, interpretations, if not definitions. It definitely has many different interpretations. So by what, Ayuko, do you think that his, you know, realization, especially he woke up that morning with Katerina, you know, he woke up with her. And then for her to be dead at that point, is he thinking in his mind, I have a second chance? You know, is that what it is?
It could be because of the fact that, like, I'm sure his whole entire life and career is always in the back of his head that, you know, addicts know they're addicts. They just don't face it, you know, and it's just like homegirl died.
Because I'm saying that because like we just talked about, it's never presented that in his mind, he's like, this was, you know, I fucked up because I was drinking.
No,
it was never like that. It's like for him. And that's what I'm saying for him to what you're saying. It's almost like, I have a second chance. Let me just, you know, turn my life around because I, you know, I survived.
So they touched on it at the end of the film. But one of the things that I think that a part of the dumping of the alcohol and all of the other vices and things like that is because there is this second chance. I think he mentioned, I can't remember when he mentioned it, but how he has a fractured relationship with Knuckles, like things like that, like his family, but one of the things of dumping and everything is like, there's a second chance because of the thing that he said. I think he was just tired of telling lies. You know what I mean? And so, and again, I don't want to, you know, get to the ending just yet, but like, I feel like that might've been maybe the accident is obviously the plane crash is the catalyst, but there's something that he knows that it's just like, okay, this is an opportunity for me to get my shit together.
Okay.
I agree with that. I think there's something else to it as well. I think there's a kind of mental aspect to it, and then there's a realistic or a reality aspect to it. He knows that he is under huge, intense scrutiny. He knows that his every move is being watched, not just by the media, but by the NTSB, the investigation that's looking into his part in the crash. So, you know, just grounded in reality, I think it's entirely realistic for somebody in that situation to say, I've got to get rid of all the evidence here. Everything that they're looking for, whether I believe it played a part or whether I didn't believe it played a part. And I don't think we can say that he didn't. I think we can say that he presented that he didn't. But I don't think we can say what was going on, of course, in his mind. Whether you're an addict or not, if people died under your watch, whether you feel you played a part or not, you wouldn't be human if you didn't second guess yourself. The other thing at play here, almost everybody has experienced something in their life where they've said, whether it's to God or the universe or whomever, you know, if I can get through this, I'll never do this again. So I think it's, again, entirely realistic that addicts go through several cycles of that in their lifetime.
But I also think that going to the farm, beginning to throw away, you know, all of this paraphernalia and liquor and reserves and all of that, I do believe that had more to do with I got away with this, as opposed to I'm going to throw this all out because I'm going to change my life. I also believe that when Denzel did go and meet with the union rep and the attorney, you know, Hugh, and it was revealed that toxicology report based off the blood that they drew from you, that now Denzel's realizing, oh, shit, you know. What ended up happening is Denzel began to, before he even really started on the road to redemption, he immediately blocked his own path, rebuked both of them.
He's embarrassed as well, right?
Right.
He's embarrassed as well at that point.
So the first place he goes to is a liquor store, buys like a gallon of vodka and a 64 pack of Budweiser or whatever it was. He's driving with the beer and everything. So it was like his trigger was, to me, his trigger was responsibility. Whenever he's faced with his own responsibility, he goes deeper, 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 deeper down the hole.
And I think it's also about who's watching, because his first, because I think it's important that we keep asserting his first attempt towards redemption was when nobody was looking.
Right.
You know, not literally, but because everybody's looking at him because he was famous.
But when he's by himself,
when he's by himself at the farm, like you said, he got away with it. You know, it wasn't his fault that the plane crashed. Nobody knew he was drunk. That had nothing to do with it in his mind, in my opinion, at that point. So he seeks redemption when nobody's really looking at him. When everybody's looking at him, when Mouse delivers the tox report.
Yeah.
And that hilarious moment I alluded to a minute ago when he's like, they take, this NTSB takes blood, hair, skin samples. It's routine. And Whip is like, okay, when they want to do that? That's when I bust out laughing. It was like, dude didn't realize. He thought it was like something like, bro, if you really think about it, that's not something they're going to do weeks after the crash.
Because he's, thinking, how much time do I have?
Exactly.
He's thinking, oh, I'm good because I went to the farm, I dumped, I've been straight, I've been clean for like
years. Trying to calculate, okay, so hang on. If they take it on Tuesday, like, then it's going to have been out by Sunday night. We're good.
At that moment, it didn't occur to him, oh, they wouldn't do that weeks after. They would have done that right after the crash. And so when Mouse tells him, they've already done it, Denzel just has that look on his face, which is funny. So anyway, at that point, he had the opportunity then, to keep, to either stay on his road to redemption or seek even higher redemption. And he chose not to. He goes, he doesn't even go to the liquor store first, Arthur. He goes to the bar.
Oh, right. Yeah. He goes to the bar.
The bar in the hotel.
In the hotel. And he's blazing.
Give me a large orange juice. Is that all you want? He thinks for a second. He says, yes, no. Give me a double Stoli. You know what I'm saying? And it was like, to your point, when the responsibility is there, when it's really important for most of this film, that he seeks redemption, he does not. He does not.
Let me ask you, gentlemen, a question. One of the things that I found interesting is the Nicole character. For me, obviously, their relationship is built on trauma bonding. But she is further along in her her own redemptive arc because of the fact that she knows that she needs help. I think she even brings him to a meeting. But what I've been trying to figure out and establish, and it could be just something with the script or the movie itself, is that like, I didn't feel that their relationship was that strong for him to come in and play Captain Seva the way that he did without knowing her. Unless I thought that is part of his redemption tied to saving, quote unquote, saving or rescuing this other character that he knows has equal part like issues as well, which were established in the hallway at the hospital. So I was trying to figure out, like, why are you bringing this stranger to the farm? Why are you so hell-bent on taking care of this person when it's like you established early on that you don't even speak to your own son? And that could be because your son is not really messing with you, but like at the same time, I just thought it was really interesting that there was like, we as the audience are supposed to believe that they had this super, super deep connection, unless it's the fact that him saving her and somehow kind of saves himself in a way.
Could it be more of a tragic, character seeking a kindred soul, kindred spirit?
Yeah, which is because trauma bonding.
Even more than the abuse or whatever. In that stairwell scene, which has to be said, James Badge Dale, who played the cancer patient, killed that. He murdered that scene.
It was
excellent. But he, Denzel's, or excuse me, Whip's attraction towards Nicole, it seems to be because he asked her, you know, where do you live? I'm gonna come see you. And the look and the kind of the intent in his voice, it wasn't disturbing. It wasn't sinister, but it was tragic. You know what I'm saying? There was something there. And, you know, I think she sensed it too. And there was something there between them. And it was interesting to me that he was sober at that point.
Right.
But when he goes to, like you said, Ayako rescue her, he's drunk.
Yeah.
You know, he's lit. And he walks in and, you know, he rescues her from the landlord. And then, you know, they proceed from there. But I don't know, that was interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's, you know, she obviously, there's a mirror kind of like moment when she says later on, I can't use again because I won't make it back. And then later on, Denzel, and that's her redemptive mode. She's on her road to redemption, redeeming herself in her own eyes. Later on, when Denzel finally finds his quote unquote moment, we'll talk about that later. He says, I just couldn't tell another lie. You know, so it was like that was there too. So it was interesting. They were on the same path, but at different points. She was much, like you said, much farther ahead than him. So I don't know why. I'm kind of torn on that. Why, you know, he was, you know, drawn to her in that way.
I'm torn on, well, I'm as many problems as I have with Nicole, there are many reasons why I like Nicole. And Nicole is the vehicle for us to be able to get inside of Whip's head. And Nicole, to me, is the wrong surrogate for his son to be involved in his father's life, because it was a complete mystery.
Saying Arthur are wrong from wrong narratively, and since that Whip made a wrong decision, or are you talking about it was wrong from the filmmaking point of view?
It was wrong from the filmmaking point of view. Nicole is useful as a gauge into Whip's mind, but the son would have been the better character to drive the to at least drive the redemptive story along.
I think that there are a lot of characters that were not necessarily as fleshed out as they could have been in this movie. I think that the flight attendant who we're introduced to in the opening scene who passes away, I think she's one of them. I think the Nicole character is another one. And I think his wife and child, his ex-wife and child, are other ones. And I think all of these people are characters who could have led him to question himself, etc. And they're all milestones that would have made it more believable for him to reach the conclusion he reaches for me at the end of the movie. I do think, though, that scene when he goes to see his wife and child and he bare hugs the child, I don't necessarily have a problem with that. I think that the wife and child, what is their own experience of this guy? He's not in their lives, right? What's other than for, you know, for child support, etc. They clearly don't really like him. Even the child clearly doesn't want to spend time with him.
Right.
What's their only experience of him? That he's a drunk, that he doesn't show up when he's supposed to show up, that he's not a father, he's not a responsible parent.
Right.
So, and you know, the addiction will not be news to them, right? That will have driven their decisions to take the positions they take with him. So when the plane goes down, etc., their first thought is not going to be mechanical failure. Their first thought is going to be like, what did this bozo do?
I'm 1,000% with you. But see, like all of that, we have to infer. You know what I mean? Like in no time during any of that exchange were they like, you know, you crashed the plane.
You're right. There could have been more to that.
Yeah,
I'm not necessarily mad that there wasn't at that point. I think maybe, you know, in that scene, it was cool. I think if they had featured throughout the movie in that dynamic, that would have been preferable for me.
Yeah, I just felt that it was disconnected from...
Yeah, but also just for your son to see you after you basically almost died is... And even I think in the hospital, he kept saying, oh, I'll call them later. Don't inform them. I'll tell them or something. Like there was...
Right.
I did feel like there was a bit of a disconnect, like... Obviously, like you said, I do feel like there might have been one too many characters like that are supposed to help illuminate his addiction issues. But like the relationships that the characters weren't as fleshed out. Like I didn't have a sense of why this, that, or the third. Unlike the flight, the second flight attendant, is it Margaret?
Exactly.
Margaret, her character, I had a firm idea of who she was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you
that
know what
scene
I mean?
Just, at the funeral was, man, it was magnificent.
She, yeah. It's just, I don't know. Like, some of the relationships, I couldn't quite figure out, you know, I don't know.
Like, Aiko, let me ask you this. Would it have been better to remove the Nicole character entirely and fill that space, both the screen time and the purpose of the character with, you know, the relationships he was experiencing with those close to him, including Margaret, who wanted him to get better, who wanted him to take responsibility for who he was and his
actually,
and his
I think she was needed. So. Maybe I think they could have retooled how they presented it, but she was the addict that actually was working on getting help. She brought him to a meeting.
You.
She, like, you know what I mean? Like, it had, they
you.
Needed,
yeah, yeah,
he
yeah.
needed an addict that took responsibility for their lives in order to move forward. And as we found out, well, I don't want to get to the ending, but that same theme had something to do with Katarina as well. That's revealed, like, certain things. And so Nicole needed to be the person that led him there, but I don't necessarily know if their relationship needed to be sexual.
See, I disagree. I think that you could have taken and removed Nicole completely out of it and halved her and have the side of, and have the, you know, the meaning side, the face your addiction side be filled by Margaret, a bigger role for Margaret, who knew him.
True.
And have the other side be the son.
I don't like this movie that you guys are writing. I don't like this at all. This feels very much more of a traditional addiction, you know, abuse film that you guys are putting together. I think for me, it was very much realistic almost that he would choose Nicole. And I say that for one thing, this film is almost entirely from Whip's point of view.
Right.
There's only a few scenes where he's not in it. And in those scenes, he's about to be shown. The scene with the airline owner when he's not in the room, but you can see Whip. The scene when Charlie and Hugh are bringing coffee to the hotel in the morning. Whip's not there, but they're entering Whip's room. The entire movie is from his point of view. And to me, that reinforced addicts are very selfish.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Addicts are very, it's about, they're living in their world. They're not, I even think it's a step of AA. I think one of the steps, the 12 steps or whatever is, you know, to, I'm paraphrasing, but to apologize for the selfishness, you know, so that reinforced the fact that we got strictly his point of view throughout the entire film reinforced his very, you know, selfishness and narrow world view is all about him. To me, it made perfect sense. His first act of redemption, his first redemptive road in the hospital, it made sense that he chose Nicole, because in her, he saw almost an empty vessel. He didn't have to answer any of the questions about his past. He didn't have to deal with any of that shit that he would have to deal with his son, with his ex-wife, with Margaret, you know, none of that. It was a clean slate. Beautiful woman. James Badgdale even says, you know, you think it's an accident, or you think it's just by choice or whatever, by a random act that you survived this plane crash and now you meet this beautiful woman in the stairwell. It made sense to me that he chose her. It made sense to me that even when he went off the redemption road and just, you know, started falling further down the abuse and the addictive road, he again chose Nicole. He went to her apartment, you know, because now he can, again, he needs just something to empty himself into, a vessel, somebody who doesn't know him. It made sense to me. It would have been I would have lost interest in the movie almost immediately had he, you know, said, let me go deal with my son and my ex-wife and I've seen that movie 1,000 times. I didn't want to see that here.
You know what? I agree with Isaac and I agree with Aiko as well. I think Aiko, I agree with the most Aiko, you drew the point that he has somebody to look to who's going through the thing that he's going through and has, you know, just like in the beginning when he was going through his, you know, his dark clouds and he found that pocket of air, which, you know, maybe that's a metaphor.
Absolutely.
She found that. She's found that and she's kind of pursuing that pocket of air and she's in there right now. I think, Arthur, with what you and I originally were suggesting, the problem is it's only people who've never been addicted, who don't understand addiction, who are trying to get him straight.
Yeah, I just don't believe that at any point Whip acknowledged that he had a problem until the very, very, very end.
I agree.
I agree with that, and that's I'm glad you said that, because that brings up a key component. For one thing, Whip is very much stuck. He's stuck for most of this film.
Yeah,
and he's drawn to a melancholy almost that he can't escape from. And I think that's another reason he's attracted to Nicole. Mm. And they picked the perfect actress, Kelly Riley. Her eyes, yeah, she has melancholy in her eyes. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Just she plays that. I've seen her in other things. And she kind of emits that very well, emanates that very well. But he's drawn to that in his farmhouse, you know, all the old pictures. The fact that his father's voice is still on the answering machine. The fact that he still has an answering machine. You know what I'm saying? The fact that you know, his setup, Jay, his stereo setup is old as hell. You know, it's like he's stuck. And that brings up also the path. You guys mentioned religion. I think we should talk about that. We should talk about God, because in religion in this film, because it's brought up, the first time it's brought up is with Margaret. Mm-hmm. Who asked him before the flight, you know, when you going to come to church with me? Mm-hmm. When the plane is going down, the wing clips the steeple of the church. Mm-hmm. The people from the John the Baptist, I wrote this down, Pentecostal mission are on the ground, starts pulling people from the wreckage. In the stairwell scene, is presented this idea of random acts of God that we call random acts, but are actually acts of God versus what we can actually control. That dichotomy is like through the entire film of, you know, can I control this, to the point where Whip and Nicole are arguing later, and Whip is making it emphatic. I choose to drink. I don't have a relationship with my son because I choose to drink. Nicole makes it a point to tell him, I don't see a lot of choice going on around here. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you think you're choosing to do this, but you're actually just on a road that something you can't control, and you need help. So that kind of like tension between what we can control and what are just like either random acts, or are the acts of God, or what are they? That's throughout the whole thing, even in the crash, because Hugh, AKA Mouse, makes it a point to tell him, look, I'm fighting to get act of God added to the list of probabilities of this accident. That's the key point for us to get you out of trouble. Because if it's not act of God, then they're going to start looking more closely at you and, you know, what you did. But we got to get active, God. So I feel that throughout this whole thing. And I don't feel that, and I agree with you, Arthur, he really does not make that choice, you know, to admit I have a problem until the very end of the film. Otherwise, throughout the whole film, he feels like he's making a choice to be an addict, you know. And I thought that was very powerful how they did that. I did think at times the whole, you know, religious aspect was played a little bit too much on the head. But I did love the fact that in the scene, like with Evans, his co-pilot, who is almost presented as a zealot, him and his wife.
Yeah.
She's got the, you know, she's like got the Jim Jones almost, you know, shit going on, you know what I'm saying? And she was like, and to the point where Evans tells him that crash was preordained. And that was so interesting, because in his eyes, I'm not going to tell on you that you were drunk, because that crash was preordained, because God is the only judge, and he has a higher plan for you. And then his wife is like, praise Jesus. And I was thinking in my mind, okay, are they trying to present that six people died and all that trauma happened because to send Whip on his road to redemption? Is that what they're saying in this film? And to me, that's still a question. I don't know. I want to get you guys' opinion on it. But that's how Evans presented it. And with all this, you know, these religious symbols throughout the whole movie, I'm wondering, is that what they're saying? Are they saying that crash was, you know, orchestrated so as almost as a random act, AKA act of God, so that Whip could finally take some control and admit he has a problem and start his road to redemption? What do you guys think about that?
I just feel like I've seen that movie too many times myself.
Yeah.
I guess the idea for me, the idea of, 'cause I saw it, you know, was this crash, you know, orchestrated, if you will, you know, for the benefit of Whip to find himself forced on that path of redemption? I do kind of find that a little easy.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's
to sort of hang the film on.
Yeah. And it's life in general. Like, unfortunately, some of our best growth as human beings comes at the, you know, other people have to suffer because of it.
I almost saw it as a crutch for Will, or a shield for Whip to hide behind.
Yeah.
I'll throw away the liquor now, but I'm absolutely going to return to it. Because, again, the more that it's reinforced that, you know what, they're looking at the mechanics of it. In fact, nobody thinks that you're the one, you know, that you're the one that caused the plane to crash. In fact, they think that you're the one that absolutely saved it. Mm-hmm. He uses all of those things, you know, as a shield, as opposed to acknowledging it as a grace.
Okay, John, do you think that there's a not necessarily a definitive, but a very visible tie between what they're saying about God and religion, or the questions they're throwing out there, and the redemption of Whip in this film? Is there a connection there?
I mean, I know the 12 steps is predicated very much on acceptance of God, etc., and a higher power. I don't necessarily know if the film draws enough of a connection there, or draws a connection effectively from a storytelling point of view. To me, specifically, when they do drop it in, from the average person's point of view, it's in an extreme way. So for example, the worshippers out in the field where the plane crashes, mm-hmm. they're portrayed as quite devout, quite orthodox. The co-pilot and his wife, as you guys have articulated, certainly were portrayed as extremely orthodox, you know. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything subtle mm-hmm. about God or religion in a way that I would expect would necessarily permeate his character to help him see, mm-hmm. you know what, that's true, mm-hmm. let me work on this. So if it was their intention, I think it was heavy-handed, and I think the examples don't really fit that.
Okay, yeah, and I you know, where I kind of come out on this is that I do think that at times, like I said, it was heavy-handed, but overall, I feel like this film does something. There's a couple things that this film does that's very, like we said, Hollywood conventional that annoyed me, but I think one thing it does that's not necessarily conventional, it throws out a question without ever really answering it, and I think that question, and especially as it has to do with the in relation to Whip's redemption or seeking of redemption, is the, you know, the idea of choice and the idea of whether, you know, again, whether you're doing something out of your own choice or God has chosen you to do that. And the cancer patient in the stairwell even asserts that God chose me to get cancer. You know, he even says that God chose me, which was weird. It was like, what do you, and he's like, had I asked for cancer, God wouldn't have gave it to me. But I didn't ask, so he gave it to me. That was the first introduction of like this kind of weird kind of like examination of choice in this film, to the point where Whip at the end of the film, before he actually, you know, tries to redeem himself, he says three words, God help me. You know what I'm saying? So that thread throughout the whole film, I thought was very interesting. And I think they throw out the idea of whether something was an act of God or not, mm-hmm. from cancer to Whip's redemption to the actual plane crash. They throw out that question without answering it. Mm-hmm. And I like that. That was good writing.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I dig that. Can I ask you guys, if each of you had to nominate a juncture of the film, a moment of the film, mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. he decides to look for redemption, what moment would that be?
There's three distinct moments. One, immediately when he, you know, in the hospital room, I think that's moment one.
Yeah.
When he wakes up and realizes, like Arthur said, that he got away with it, and that he survived. And, you know, we talked about the whole second chance thing. I think that was his first decision to redeem himself, which is why he went to the farm and, you know, Harling asked him, you know, do you want me to bring this, that, and the third? And he's like, nah, I'm cool. Just bring me the veal, which was the money. And he dumped all the alcohol. That was one. Two, he had the choice to redeem himself at the hotel breakfast when it was revealed, the toxicology report was revealed, and he chose not to. Mm-hmm. And then I think the third one was at the hearing at the end.
Aiko?
Yes, I agree with that. I would add, there's one more little plot point in there that they did as well, is when they first introduce who's going to have to take responsibility for the vodka in the trash bin. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. I think that when they start to introduce, like, so this is who is going to take the fall for it, mm-hmm. is the first point of what clicks, like, oh, like, what are you going to choose? And that's a huge part of it as well.
I 100% agree with you.
Can I say that I think that all of you are wrong?
Oh.
I think the tipping point for him is at the end of the film, on the way to the hearing, in the elevator, when Denzel is looking at the little girl, mm-hmm. and she's looking back at him, and he is faced with what he knows her image of him is, and what he represents to her, and she becomes basically like the public. You know what I'm saying? She's the face of those who view his image, his persona that he has to adopt in order to face these kinds of things while he's wiping his nose.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I disagree, though.
I feel that that's the first time that he's really faced.
I mean, it's a very clear moment. It's a bit of a sledgehammer, but it's
that's what I was like when it happened. I was like, okay, all right, yeah, she's looking at him, he's bleeding. I'm like, yeah, I get it.
But why would he
care
more? I agree
with everything you're saying, Arthur. I just felt it was heavy-handed.
Yeah, it was heavy-handed, because why would he care more about that but not about Knuckles, or, like, you know what I mean? Like, these things along the way, like, you care
because she's a little girl, Aiko, and she's in an elevator, and the music was playing. The music wasn't playing, actually.
I agree with both of you. But I do think that, you know, in the life of an addict, very often there's a kind of straw that breaks the camel's back.
Mm-hmm. So you agree with Arturo?
No, I mean, it was a little bit sledgehammery from a Hollywood perspective. Well, but I kind of see where it's going. I mean, the moment for me actually was probably the only time that we really see him. Well, that's not true, actually. We see him really struggle with alcohol.
The raging drunk.
When he's in the hotel room, mm-hmm. the night mm-hmm. before the trial. Or the night before the hearing, and all he's got to do mm-hmm. is stay clean, and they've emptied out mm-hmm. the bar, and they put orange juice and Coke and Coca-Cola in there, not cocaine, and it's, you know, it's all kind of completely baby-proof or addict-proof. And then just by one pure quirk of circumstance, some hotel employee hasn't properly locked the partition.
Act of God,
right. And, you know, he's allowed to go in there. He sees the minibar in the hotel room adjoining his. The room is empty. He looks at the bar. We all know what he's thinking. He's been there a million times. They give us a lot of struggle. There's some good use of silence and space and wind, etc., because the adjoining room, the window is open. And that is what is triggering the door banging next to him to make him realize that it's not properly locked. But mm-hmm. so there's a lot of struggle there. And that's a really big moment. But I think the best moment of struggle in the film is when he leaves that first breakfast meeting. He goes to the bar in the hotel where the breakfast meeting was held, and he sits down, and you talked about it, Isaac, where he orders the orange juice and then he orders the alcohol. That's the first moment where we see doubt, I think, in his face, in his performance, in his mind. That's the first moment to me where he's like, should I be doing this? I probably shouldn't be doing this.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, man. I think y'all sleeping on that elevator. Because, I mean, I'm saying this because when he gets on the elevator, you know, he's
high as fuck, by the way.
He's whipped. Yeah. He's back. The big dog is back, you know. But when he sees the child, that breaks it all. That breaks all that image up for him. Like, all of that just starts to crack.
Yeah.
And that's why he breaks in the hearing at the end.
But I think overall, to answer your question, though, John, your original question, it feels like there's a lot of redemptive fork roads where he could have went this way or that way. And most often he chose the wrong way. But that scene, you know, that you described, John, when you see the vodka bottle on top of the refrigerator and it's just like the camera just stays there. And as when the camera stayed there for like 1 second, I was like, oh, he's not going to do it.
He's going to walk away.
After 2 seconds, I said his hand is about to come back in mm-hmm. the frame. And when it did, even though I knew it was going to happen, it was still a very powerful moment.
My heart actually jumped. I'm like, oh, whip.
It's almost like we hear his hand coming before we see it.
We hear him falling. You know, we hear him just, you know, you thought he was safe. And then all of a sudden, whoop, you know, it's like he just falls. And you know what? That to me, this film did a really good job almost all the way up throughout the whole thing of really just spotlighting the inability. You know, how substance abuse is just so terrible.
Absolutely.
Man.
Yes.
So terrible. And all of us have had, you know, people close to us who we've seen that. And it's like the inability. Even mm-hmm. Charlie looks at him and says, you are on about to face a federal inquiry about X, Y, and Z, a plane that crashed, six people died, you were high as hell, and you are out getting drunk. What kind of crazy does that? That's what Charlie says. Because it's like, for a sober person, it's like, what, you know what I'm saying? It's like, you can't wrap your mind around it. And we've all had family members or people close to us continue to go to fall. And it's like, that and I think this film did it. It just showed the inability for him you know, by himself. And it was like, that's why Nicole told him, you have to get help. You know, you have to get help. You can't do this by yourself. So sticking with the whole idea of redemption here. And, you know, I think that there's one, I don't want to call it a flaw, but I think one thing that was very much overlooked in this film. During the uprisings in the summer of 2020, a person of color commented to me that, you know, this is just terrible, you know, and we've all heard this, you know, the looters, it was terrible, you know.
Yeah.
And this particular person, I just asked them, you know, I already knew the answer, but I said, well, why do you think that? And they said, well, it just makes us look bad. And we've all heard that from black folks before, right?
Yeah.
And then during the Capitol riots of early in January of this year, it struck me how many people of European descent watched that and said, wow, this really makes white people look bad. Probably not many, right?
Right.
So that speaks to the fact of, in this country, you know, there is that sense of a lot of us, not all of us, but a lot of us African-Americans seeking some sort of redemption in the eyes of, you know, society. Redemption for what? I don't know. But, you know, it's that sickness. You know, we can talk. That's a whole different show. This movie, I think, missed the boat on that, because had this been written by a black screenwriter, I'm fairly certain, especially in the scene where you see, you know, like you said earlier, Arthur, Easy Rollins and Mouse, you know, back together, standing on that platform together. Had a black writer, now it's not guaranteed, all black writers don't write alike, but I think there would have been a stronger chance for a black writer would have said, okay, to introduce the idea of, this is a black pilot who just saved, you know, 90 something people in a plane that by all means should have crashed and killed everybody.
Right.
At some point, Cheadle's character probably would have been like, brother, you have a chance to, you know, not only escape this, but to come out of this a hero, and put that in the black context. You see what I'm saying? We know that being black in this country changes everything about every situation, right? Not everything, but a lot of things. It just puts a different point of view on things. So for this movie, for all these things to happen in this movie, and that race never entered the picture, I found that inauthentic, in the sense that I know that, you know, that race definitely would have entered the picture if this was more realistic. But then I also realized this is a white filmmaker, and I believe the screenwriter is John Gattins is white as well. They didn't introduce that into this picture, and I filled into this film. And I feel like that was kind of in the context of redemption, there's no way in the world that wouldn't have been a part of the redemptive qualities of this film had more black influence been in this.
Absolutely.
You see what I'm saying?
Because we also know what respectability politics are. And so therefore you're right. Like, somebody would have said, like, yo, like, as a black pilot, the whole world is watching, like, you know, this goes beyond just you being a pilot. Like, you're representing us on some level, whether you want to or not. Like, it's true. You know,
you have to get clean for us.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta what I'm saying? That would have been said. Bruce, Hugh, AKA Mouse, would have pulled him aside.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And be like, okay, Charlie, go stand over there.
And checked him. Yeah.
Let me talk to you, Whip. You got to get, you know what I'm saying? Everybody's looking at you. You have a chance to be, you could be on a stamp one day, bro. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, that's what's at, you know, you could redeem, you know, and it's, and not to say, again, that's why I brought up the you know, the example of the uprisings and the reaction to that. I don't, you know, I don't sign off on that at all, that we should be seeking redemptions in the eye of our colonizer. I don't agree with that at all. But I know that that's a reality of the mind state of many black people in this country, and it's hard for me to believe that all of this would have happened without race entering the picture at all. And I think that's just a result of this was not a film created by black filmmakers.
Yeah. And I think that because of that, there was a flaw in the NTSB hearing, because the questioning by, I think it was Agent Block, played by Melissa Leo, you know, I mean, it was the whole thing was softball questions. If a black pilot, it's like she'd have got right to the chase. Like that'd have been the front end of the thing. She'd have saved that whole PowerPoint deck about how the plane was fault. That'd have been after the sex and the drugs.
You said she would start off. Were you drunk?
Yeah, yeah. It would have been a much more aggressive hearing. Yeah,
it would have, you know, where did you train? Where did you, you know, there would be these kind of microaggressions.
Microaggressions.
You know, kind of like demeaning his qualifications, you know.
Right. Do you think you're special?
Okay.
Right. I just think the approach would have been very different. And it's not like they had to change any dialogue. It's just really the approach of how that hearing would have been. It would have been different.
Would that have made the film better for you guys?
I mean, like I talked earlier about the missed opportunity that I feel with the emphasis on his relationship with his son. Mm-hmm. And forgive me, I mean, I got like real He Got Games vibes from it between the Shuttlesworth.
Good one.
Father Good and one. Son pairing, you know. But we'd have got some, you know, some more Denzel greatest hits out of it, right? Because he does that very well.
Yeah.
Let me say this. What I did like about the hearing itself, I did like that what finally broke him was facing the reality that in order for him to walk scot-free, he would have had to railroad homegirl.
Throw her under the bus. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like when he finally stuck his flag in the sand, it was going to be because he was not going to denigrate her memory.
But, you know, I really struggled with it because I'm like, you know, the agent, Melissa Leo, whatever her character's name, she already brought up that old girl had issues, like, you know, that she'd gone to rehab before. And so I'm like, what would have, if she saved a child and they brought that up, like, what would have been so bad necessarily for them to know, like, oh, she had two drinks on the plane. She didn't cause the accident. Yeah, she wasn't in control of anything. She wasn't like, it just would have been like, I'm like, you went to jail and all this other stuff. Like, you couldn't have just maybe started this process as soon as the court hearing was done. I'm like, what? Like, you know, maybe like, again, for him, he couldn't tell one
couldn't
more
tell
lie.
One more
and
lie.
I get that. But I'm just like, you
y'all
know.
Y'all sleeping on the elevator. I'm telling you. telling you.
But I was just like, yo, just three drinks? Really?
I agree with Ayuko 100%. And I think that it would have been fine to be as is had they set it up a little bit more. Like, had, you know, when Union Rep asks him, you know, you knew Katrina, all he says is, yeah, I spent a little time with her. Mm-hmm. You know, to have that character present in the beginning, to have her present in her death,
right?
To have her present when he's being told of her death. Mm-hmm. And then we don't hear about her again.
Right.
For like, you know, 45 minutes, an hour or something, zero in his life. She's like no presence at all, no meaning at all in his life. And then right at the end, she pops up again. So I'm with Aiko because of that. I think it was cool the way it was done. Had it been just set up a little bit more.
Yeah, like her family, maybe not like her family thinking something like, yo, I don't want my daughter. Like, this is their legacy. Like, you know, like something to show like, okay, well, why was it so important for you to finally take responsibility in this particular scene with her memory? Like, bless her heart. Like, she's already gone.
But I think that proves your point, though, Aiko. I think that had they decide if they wanted to make it about him not wanting to throw her under the bus, like that was it. I think to your point, yeah, they should have, you know, done everything you just said. But I think the implication, it wasn't really about, as much as I would like to believe that he didn't want to throw the sister under the bus. I think that was just kind of like a bonus. I think it was really he couldn't tell another lie. I think that was it. I think that was he had just ran out of, it's like he says, I just got to a point. I was like, I couldn't. I ran out of lies. You know, after 50 years or whatever of telling him, I just ran out of lies. I had a, you know, because my thing was that if he wanted to escape that, and this is why I say, yeah, it was about him not being able to tell another lie, because he could have easily just said, listen, she saved a kid's life. You don't have any proof that she drank anything. There's, you know, nobody had access to that. But that's not to say a passenger could have stolen something. That's not to say the flight, the craft services or whoever didn't F up and put, you know, miscount the number or whatever. You know what I'm saying? There's a million things could happen. We don't know. She's not here. She saved somebody's life. I'm not going to sit here and let you denigrate her.
Right.
He didn't have to say, I drank it. You know what I'm saying?
He like, didn't. It could have just been a mystery. But he was high.
So I think it was definitely about him not being able to tell another lie. He just ran out of lies.
But he was high. He didn't, you know what I mean?
his life is about to go down. Arthur was like, he made clear decisions when a plane was about to crash. He's proven it. He can keep his mind
clear. He was more high at the trial than he was on the plane, right?
He might have been, Jahan, but like the thing is they set that up in part of the film. They set it up already telling you who was going to take the fall. If he didn't say he drank the vodka, he had time to figure out how
when they introduced the whole point, because he was like, Bruce or Hugh was like telling him, you know, when he first introduced the point, like, we're gonna have to blame Trina for this, I'd have been like, why? You know what I'm saying? Like, we ain't gotta blame nobody. Okay. It's a mystery. You know, write a book about it.
You're talking also as somebody who isn't an addict, right? When you're an addict, you're living in constant fear of discovery. When you're an addict who's accused of basically doing something that will have broken several federal laws and resulted in the death of six human beings, you're even more in fear of being discovered.
Nah, I kind of agree with you, but I think ultimately it just comes down, he couldn't tell another lie. That's because he did do as much. I think it was intended that he did as much alcohol the night before in the opening of the movie, and then he took that hit of cocaine to straighten himself out. Same thing happened at the end of the movie. He got drunk. He got really messed up to the point where he passed out, cracked his head on the toilet seat, and then he had to get straightened out in the morning. So it was like, it was almost like, you know, bookended, you know, too. So he was just as high. They wanted him just as high at the trial as he was when he pulled off the miracle landing. So he's capable of keeping his mind clear. I think what happened was exactly what he said. I couldn't tell any more lies.
And that is a wrap. Find us online at snobsonfilm.com, where our entire library of shows are streamed. Even better, you can subscribe to our podcast in Apple Podcasts. We ask that you leave a review and rate the show. It really does help with discovery. We can also be followed on Spotify, and we are distributed in everywhere that fine RSS feeds are consumed. See you next show.